Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Moussa Sissoko claiming that Jan Vertonghen, who frankly probably couldn't tell me his own name last night, will be fine for the weekend for Tottenham. I don't think I can say enough about how little these people understand concussion, the seriousness of it, or how dangerous it can be. And we'll talk later about second impact syndrome, and Dawn Astle's had a lot to say, the daughter of the late Jeff Astle, who is a big campaigner on dementia and football and the lack of research into that. We'll talk more about that later, but I want to talk about the problems with football and head injuries. We know the rules. We know that the referee is supposed to stop the game when there's a head injury, that there are certain protocols medical staff have to follow, and we saw it last night. Jan Vertonghen headed the back of Toby Alderweireld's head and got a pretty nasty gash on the nose for his troubles. He was left bleeding on his back in the penalty area. They treated him for a while, and he was helped off, but he looked pretty groggy. At which point, he started telling the medical staff he wanted to come back on. He wanted to go back on, and the referee came over, checked they'd gone through all the protocols, and eventually he was allowed back onto the pitch, and he didn't last long. And it wasn't a surprise when he came back to the touchline, basically threw up and almost couldn't make it into the tunnel on his own 2 feet. Remarkable, really. It was quite harrowing to see, actually, because those injuries, if you know how serious they can be, you know how serious it is that you don't go and get hit in the head again. Let's talk to someone who knows a lot more about this than me. Ben Dinnery is an injury data analyst, and he's on the line now. Ben, it must have been quite worrying for someone like you who knows how serious these things can be to see Jan Vertonghen try and play on through what, to me, even on TV, looked like a fairly obvious serious concussion.
It's a very difficult situation to manage. And certainly, you know, these instances often look a lot worse than they are in reality. You know, but watching some of the TV cameras, and it looked a pretty horrific injury. And it's always very difficult because what we're trying to sort of second guess the medical practitioners who are dealing with the incident on the pitch. So we don't know, you know, what's going on, and we can't rule out the possibility that, you know, the protocol was implemented. And at the time, you know, Vertonghen was fine. He may have deteriorated rapidly after that initial protocol assessment. You know, but at the time as well, like I say, he could have been fine. He could have been responding to cognitive tests, both short and long-term memory tests. The player himself may have come out and said, you know, I'm absolutely fine, no problem. I think, you know, there are a number of factors here that come into play. I think the nose injury was a major distraction as well. You know, so the focus may have been taken from the concussion and maybe focused on the nose, but at that specific point, like I say, we can't rule out that he did not pass all of the protocol assessments, and he was fit in theory to go back out on the pitch. However, if you want to adopt, you know, the principles which underpin the, you know, the Football Association's concussion protocol, you know, if there are any doubts whatsoever, then you remove the player. And that there, you know, but these people are under a lot of pressure. Is, you know, there was it's a big game. You look at how the game was panning out and how pivotal Jan Vertonghen is to Mauricio Pochettino's side. You know, and given the scoreline and given, you know, the players, evidently he's come out and said, look, I'm fine, it's just me nose. And it was after those events when he come back on, obviously he deteriorated and became a lot more evident that there was concussion came into play.
For me, you know, you're right, it is a high-pressure situation for everyone involved. But for me, and I'm sort of minded of a number of times, Eva Carnera being the most public one, but so many times you see managers get annoyed with physios for not letting players on or for, you know, telling players that they're injured when players say they're not. For me, this should be taken out of team hands. Surely there should be, especially with head injuries, an independent doctor who comes and says, yes, you're fine, or no, you're not, and his word is final. Take the badge off the chest and make it much easier, surely.
Yes, I 100% agree. I can't argue with that. I think, you know, as has been suggested today, where we have a little bit of a, you know, a timeout for these tests and assessments to carry on, maybe on the sidelines, by an independent medical expert to check if there's any sort of brain trauma and injury there. And, you know, and they make the decision on whether a player is able to return to play or not. You know, concussion differs from maybe other injuries that they may suffer. And whereas there, a lot of those are player-led. You know, are you fine to continue? Can you continue? Yes. But if there has been some kind of impairment and you believe that the player isn't able to make a rational decision or, you know, a reasonable comeback, then, you know, it needs to be taken out of the player's hands. And that's a decision then of the medical practitioner.
Do you think football takes concussion seriously enough yet?
Definitely not. You know, I'm a Newcastle United supporter. And just last month, we seen the incident with Fabian Shaw. Mm. Now, clearly, he was actually knocked unconscious. Yeah. You know, in protocol, you know, there's no grey area with that. You know, with Jan Vertonghen, it was very difficult. Although, you know, we all have an opinion on what happened and what we think happened. But ultimately, it's that assessment needs to happen. With Fabian Shaw, he was actually knocked unconscious. You know, he was out for a few seconds. And yet he was treated on the pitch and then he was allowed to continue.
Yeah.
I just wonder, you know, what are the ramifications for allowing this to happen? At what point does somebody, you know, take a step back and say, we need to deal with this? And it's my concern and my worry that, you know, it's going to take something quite severe and horrific to happen before the authorities maybe, you know, stand up and implement change.
Yeah, unfortunately, the saying goes that safety regulations are written in blood, and that is more true every day. And I also think that football kind of fetishizes the playing through injury. You know, we all know the story, and there's a recent film out about it, of Bert Trautmann breaking his neck in the cup final, but bravely staying on because, you know, he wanted to fight through it. He could have died. He could have been paralyzed because he played through an injury. And I'm sure there are countless of other examples up and down. Do you think it needs to come from, does it come from the FA? Does it come from the PFA? I read an interesting quote today, I think from a former Scotland first team doctor, saying that this needs to come from the players. They need to be the people who lead on this. Does that seem likely?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of sort of injury management, you know, it rarely do players go out on the pitch 100%, particularly toward the end of the season, you know, after a long, hard campaign. And it's all about assessing, you know, the risk and minimising that and understanding that, you know, the limitations and making an informed return to play decision in conjunction with, you know, the medical practitioners and the managers and the coaches. So you've got all of that information to hand. But like I say, when it comes to concussion, really, you know, you take the player out of that decision-making process on the pitch. You know, your ruling, your responsibility, you have a duty of care to make sure that that player, you know, is not only remains safe in the present time, but also for the future career. Mm. So I think, you know, there's a long way to go and there's a lot of things that will need to happen before, you know, we're happy with the protocol that's been put in place.
Mm. Just finally, Ben, of course, Tottenham have plenty of other injury worries, not least Harry Kane, who still managed to get more airtime than someone like Kieran Trippier last night because every time they missed a chance, Kane popped up. What are the chances, do you think, of him returning anytime soon?
I've heard suggestion that Harry Kane could potentially be back for the second leg of the Champions League semi-final. And I would suggest that, you know, it's a little bit optimistic. If you had asked me, you know, last week, I would have said there was no chance of a return within, you know, before the end of the Premier League. And we would sort of reassess the situation if Tottenham, you know, made the Champions League final. And I'm still very, of, you know, much of that mind. Although, you know, we always talk about how quick a healer Harry is with his ankle. So, you know, I would never say never, but I would say, you know, it's highly unlikely at this stage that he will be back before the end of the Premier League campaign.
Ben, thanks very much for joining us. Time's run out on us, but great to hear from you as always. That's Ben Dinnery, injury data analyst. And there's so much going around today about injuries, not just Harry Kane, not just Heung-Min Son, but that horrific blow for Jan Vertonghen. Are we dealing with concussion the right way in football? I don't think we are.
Love Sport.
I said it was a busy show and Alex Hales is contributing to that by failing to put to bed his recreational drugs use. Second failed test, which of course saw him dropped from the preliminary Cricket World Cup squad by England earlier this week. Guy Watts has joined me in the studio, Love Sport's very own, to discuss this. More in the papers today. It feels like journalists are really starting to get their teeth into this and mostly get their teeth into Alex Hales.
Bizarre the ECB not managing to bury a bad news story. I don't know how this has happened. Yeah, as Lawrence Booth points out in the Mail today, the Wisden editor, of course also a writer for the Mail, this is now dragging into a fifth day, and I should think there are many days left to rumble yet. Alex Hales hit back, of course, a couple of days ago, and now it seems that the England team itself has had a bit of a chance to give its own feelings. No one's come forward and spoken publicly. In fact, in public, we heard yesterday from James Vince, who is actually, ironically, the man most likely to benefit from Hales being dropped from the World Cup squad. He's already in the squad now for the Pakistan One Day Internationals, and if he gets a chance in those and scores any runs, you imagine he'll be in the World Cup squad. He said, look, Hales is a good friend of mine and I know he's going through a really tough time. I feel sorry for him. The England players involved in the squad already, though, seem to be offering rather less sympathy. The line coming out today is that basically they weren't sorry to see the back of him. He cut a withdrawn figure during the training camp in Cardiff over the weekend, which could yet prove to be the last time that he is indeed part of any England squad or England camp. He, yeah, as I say, was withdrawn there. He didn't take the opportunity, maybe more importantly, to apologise to his teammates. And you may say that, you know, he doesn't feel he's done an awful lot wrong, or he certainly hasn't committed a heinous crime. Maybe he thinks there are other people there who have got away with something similar. I don't know what his logic would have been, but it does seem a little bit strange, given that you do have a bit of history as well, to not take the chance to just say, guys, look, I've really messed this one up. It's bad publicity we didn't need. I promise you this was in the past, and it's a long time ago, and actually I've had my wake-up call already, and it's not going to happen between now and the end of the summer at the very least. They might not have bought it, but at least he said it.
Yeah, unfortunately, standing there with a smoking gun, no pun intended. I think it's interesting reading the Telegraph today, because they, I don't know whether they've got more or whether they've just gone stronger with it, but it certainly seems they were saying senior players were surprised that he failed to apologise to the group. Now, that also suggests that they already knew it was true, or at least believe the media reports, or that, it, you know, there was no suggestion to me, as far as I can tell, that the report came out on Friday and that there was a whisper in the dressing room going, oh, this is just one of those things in the media. They all believed it straight away.
But I guess once you're serving a ban already, you get the impression that official protocol has been followed, if you like. Even if you were to be surprised by the identity of the person guilty of doing this, you might think, well, I am surprised, but clearly he has done it, because otherwise he wouldn't be serving the ban. Worth pointing out a quote that is essentially attributed to an unnamed source, but that we don't need a cloud everywhere we go. And you can understand that feeling. They're probably already a couple of characters in that camp, even if some of them are more unflappable, thinking, God, if I have a bad innings, if we have a bad game, the media is going to get right on us, not liking the idea of how actually the World Cup could play out if things don't go perfectly for England, and thinking that actually Alex Hales being around is only going to bring more bad publicity. You might argue more cynically that he'd be a good deflecting board, if you like, a good lightning conductor of some of the other failings if things were to go wrong. But I think ultimately it's a good sign that they were pleased to see the back of him, because clearly he's disruptive in more ways than one. Trevor Bayliss, it points out in the Mail, it's felt, does not feel he can trust him anymore. And when your coach doesn't trust you, you're not going to be welcome in the squad.
No, and it seems like Owen Morgan has got to that point as well. And I wouldn't be surprised, and I said this yesterday, I wouldn't be surprised if the way this story got out was the players, one of them, some of them, I don't know, realising, oh, they're not going to drop Hales, are they? Oh, we better, let's make sure that they do, essentially, because all the questions, and there still will be some, although I think they're going to send Ashley Giles to Ireland on Friday in an effort to avoid, you know, sort of take some of the questions. But all of the questions are going to be about Hales if he's still in the squad.
Well, they are. I think they are anyway, to be completely honest.
But not, but not for the, you know, the World Cup is now 29 days away.
Yeah, well, that's their that's the big problem here. The World Cup's 29 days away, and Ashley Giles, it's not just going to be what do you make of having a player who was meant to be in the squad doing these things. It's going to be, why were you happy to keep him in the squad? What has been essentially confirmed in the last day or two is that the only people who knew in the England setup were CEO Tom Harrison and Ashley Giles. That should have been enough for the decision to be made. It should not have taken it to come out in the media for the decision to be made. Trevor Bayliss and Owen Morgan, the coach and the captain, for goodness sake, were finding out the same way that you and I were when it flashed up on our TV screens, when it was published on our Twitter account, or if you were on the Guardian website at the right moment. That is how they found out. That is ludicrous. And Ashley Giles and Tom Harrison have a lot to answer for. It is not a good enough way to be running a top-level sporting team, not at any time, and especially not at this time. It's interesting to read as well that they are talking quite seriously, apparently, within the ECB of changing their laws, their regulations, if you like, and rules on their recreational drugs policy. There have been a lot of people saying, hey, 21 days for a second offence. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's recreational drugs, and I'm someone who for a long time has argued that the punishments in some sports for recreational drugs are too severe. 21 days, 3 weeks, that does not seem long enough. And also the fact that the player is, in theory, ironically, allowed to remain anonymous. And I think it's right probably that that changes as much from a welfare point of view as it is from a crime and punishment point of view. We heard Richard Gold, the Surrey chairman, talk about how it was wrong that the players can essentially, how the clubs cannot find out about their own players having a potential drug issue, because the more people that know, the more chance there is of that person getting the help they need.
Exactly. And look, we don't want to draw comparisons between, for example, the tragic story of Tom Maynard, who obviously had his own problems and his own battles with drugs. But that was one of those situations where the club weren't aware of the severity of the problem necessarily, and it did end up spiralling out of control. And that's a kind of a cautionary tale, if nothing else.
No, it absolutely is, and it is relevant because it was in the wake of his tragic death 7 years ago now. I can still remember it so clearly, but it was 7 years ago, I think, probably almost to the month. And that was what prompted the change in the rules around recreational drug use. And rightly so, and it's always tragic when it takes something so big to change certain laws.
It's how safety regulations are changed. They're written in blood.
It is. And the other kind of more practical thing, just to point out, that Lawrence Booth points out today, there are still concerns, and this is related, of course, to Alex Hales and James Vince and all the rest of it. Jason Roy is still struggling with back spasms. He's not going to be part of the game against Ireland on Friday, and he hasn't played, of course, since April the 23rd. He apparently is, you know, quite accustomed to suffering with these problems, but maybe once or twice a year, and they're not normally used to keep him out for so long. You might hope that having had one now, he might not have one again until after the World Cup.
Yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, you just sort of get them out of the way. That's key. You know, it's like holiday. You just book them early in the year. Well, I mean, England have called up James Vince, as we know. Ben Duckett, David Milan are involved as well. We expect all three of them to play. Joffre Archer will probably make his England debut.
Yeah,
well,
the three mentioned there, or two of them, sorry, Duckett and Milan, they're just involved in the Ireland game, the one day, and the 2020 international against Pakistan as it stands. If Jason Roy were to be ruled out for any more, James Vince is already in the squad for the 5-1 days against Pakistan. If Jason Roy is to be ruled out for any more, then maybe Ben Duckett gets another chance. And who knows, if Jason Roy is ruled out, you know, let's hope he's not. He's absolutely vital to our hopes and plans. But if he's ruled out for longer, then Ben Duckett could be, it looks like, the main beneficiary of that down the line.
And of course, you want to talk about team environment. Ben Duckett, brilliant at team bonding exercises. The man who was famously sent home from Australia for pouring a pint over Jimmy Anderson's head.
Don't let him near the bowlers in nightclubs.
Jimmy Anderson won't be in the ODI squad anyway. It'll be fine.
Love sport.
Graham Souness on Virgin Media Sport, joining the Sam Allardyce Club as people who don't think tactics really matter and we talk about them too much. I couldn't disagree with you more, Graham, because it's systems that make teams work. Yes, there are levels of commitment, and yes, if you have a couple of people who aren't committed, you're going to lose a game. But if you think I want to sit there and listen to Graham Souness say, well, Paul Pogba just doesn't have the commitment anymore, I'm not interested, Graham. Tell me about why Paul Pogba isn't an effective footballer beyond the fact that you don't think he tries hard sometimes. Tell me how you need to motivate him. Just tell me something about him that's not just, I just don't think he works very hard. It's not worth it, unfortunately. And there's a lot of people of a certain generation who do think there's far too much talked about tactics in the game. I don't think Souness is cutting off on the right foot there. And I think that's why he's a relatively unpopular pundit, because people don't think he adds an awful lot. Well, I'll tell you someone who adds an awful lot to the show when he comes on. Alan O'Brien is on the line of Tactics Truck version 2.0. Alan, I don't know if you heard much of Graham Souness there. I can't imagine you agree with his point of view that tactics don't matter that much.
Yeah, I saw his outburst, his little rant on Virgin Media last night, actually, Graham Souness. And I think he may have read an article by one of my fellow countrymen, Ken Early, in the Irish Times, which many English-based journalists shared there on Monday, which basically excoriated Graham Souness and some of his fellow ex-pros for their complete inability to grasp the modern game that is unrecognisable from the more simple and less systemised version that they played 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, and I think Sam Allardyce probably throw him into that one as well, the man who thinks that there's too much of this passing nonsense in football. Let's move on from the gammon complaining about modern football and talk about last night's game. It looks like, and the sort of common consensus is, a big tactical mistake from the start by Mauricio Pochettino. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do, yeah. He went with the same 3-5-2 or 3-5-1-1 system that he used against Manchester City a couple of weeks ago in the 1-0 defeat. And in that game, admittedly, Spurs were rather unlucky in that they created two clear-cut chances and wasted them. Both their strikers on the day, Son and Lucas Moura, missed one apiece. Now, Son was obviously suspended last night, but he still went with that 3-5-2 system. Again, the problem with it was that on this occasion, the 3-5-2 was unable to deal with Ajax's press. Now, we know that Ajax play very similarly to Manchester City. Their manager, Erik ten Hag, is a former disciple of Pep Guardiola and an admirer of his from the Bayern Munich days. But for whatever reason, Ajax were much better in their version of the system at preventing Spurs from playing out from the back, because Ajax's front three, which play very high, like Manchester City's front three, were able to confront Spurs centre-backs man for man. And it was a problem that Mauricio Pochettino really only resolved after 20, 30 minutes when he switched to a back four.
Of course, he was kind of forced into that decision by the Jan Vertonghen injury, and well, we could talk about that all day, but that moving to that four at the back and bringing on Moussa Sissoko, what do you think Sissoko himself changed about the game? What did he add to Tottenham tactically that maybe they didn't have before, other than just a body?
Yeah, I think he added two things. First of all, I think with the likes of Harry Winks absent, Spurs were not very resistant to pressure in midfield. Harry Winks, as we know, is a very, very good footballer. He has techniques such that he can kind of evade opposition pressure, much like Ajax's Frankie de Jong did last night on several occasions. But without him, you know, they had Wanyama, who was completely frazzled by the pressure of Ajax. He misplaced half his passes in the first half, roughly. And, you know, they needed someone who was able to withstand that kind of relentless pressure. And the frame of Moussa Sissoko, who is, you know, custom built to withstand pressure from all sides.
Or withstand almost anything, frankly. Storms, you know, hard winters. He looks like a bloke who can cope with almost anything.
He certainly does, yeah. And that statement, James, works in a tactical sense as well, because he's been employed in several different roles for France and Spurs and Newcastle over the last few years. Not always to great effect. But the second thing he added as well was, you know, energy and dynamism in leading, well, not leading, but in helping Spurs press, which was very ineffective from the start last night. They really didn't stop Ajax from building from the back at all. They had the two strikers up against Ajax's two centre-backs, but unfortunately, the two wing-backs for Spurs, Trippier and Rose, were reluctant to go too high because of Ajax's wingers and their aggressive positioning. That meant that Ajax's full-backs, Veltman and Tagliafico, were always free, and Ajax's goalkeeper, Onana, played lots of excellent long passes to both fullbacks to get Ajax out. But when Sissoko came on, I think Spurs had a little bit more energy that kind of buttressed their press from behind and enabled them to put Ajax under more difficulty when they had the ball. And we saw that ultimately, for the last hour of the game, Spurs made a contest of it after looking completely overwhelmed in the first half hour.
Alan O'Brien gets recruited by Mauricio Pochettino tomorrow, and you're given the task of setting Spurs up for the second leg. What do you change?
Well, I don't know if you watched the Brighton game there. Was it last Monday?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in pieces. Yeah, sure.
Or it was midweek last week, actually, I think.
Yeah.
Perhaps last Tuesday, when Spurs got a late winner through Christian Eriksen, who was peripheral last night. They used, actually, funnily enough, we're talking about Pep Guardiola influences here. They used a very, very Manchester City-like 4-3-3. Now, although it took them time to break down Brighton, they were very, very effective in the first half with that system. They were unlucky not to score against Chris Hughton's all-out defence side. They had two wingers staying very, very wide, like City do with Sané and Sterling. I think it was Son and Moura on the day, with Llorente playing as a lone striker, and with Ali and Eriksen playing as dual number 10s in the manner that David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne have to do for City. I think that might give Spurs more join. I'll tell you why, because as I said, those Ajax fullbacks were always free last night. They didn't get put under any pressure either in the defensive phase or in the attacking phase. And I think particularly the left back for Ajax, the Argentinian Nicolas Tagliafico, he is a particularly weak link. In the first half last night, he got a stupid yellow card for a lunge on Christian Eriksen. He was also dribbled three times and he committed two other fouls. And at no point did Spurs actually put a man on him like Moura or Sissoko and test him in that second half. They stuck with the narrow diamond. I think that was a mistake. If they put Moura or the returning son on Tagliafico, play with genuine attacking width, the type of width that the likes of Trippier and Rose were unable to provide last night, I think Spurs might have a slender chance, but really only a slender chance, because remember, James, Spurs have only won one out of the last nine away games.
Just quickly, Alan, because we're looking forward to it tonight, I just want to pick your brains a little bit. I assume you've got a theory about how to stop Lionel Messi, or is it simply hope he has a bad night?
Yeah.
All right, good, excellent, ideal. As a Liverpool fan, Alan, that really doesn't give me much hope. Is there any way to stop Barcelona? Do you see any hope for Liverpool in Barcelona tonight?
Well, look, I mean, we look back to Barcelona's last contest in the Champions League against Manchester United, and you'll remember, James, that particularly in the opening parts of both legs, Barcelona struggled massively with Manchester United's high press, which is something that United aren't particularly good at and have only really started to use semi-frequently under Solskjaer. So there is, I think, an opportunity there for Liverpool to do what they did to Huddersfield on Friday night, which is to get in Barcelona's defenders' faces early and try and provoke an error. And remember, in that second leg, although Manchester United were ultimately completely overwhelmed, United had, I spoke to you on the radio about this actually at the time, the day after, United had two clear-cut chances in the first couple of minutes when they got through due to Barcelona losing their composure in the face of United pressure. So I think that's Liverpool's best chance. And look, these days they have an outstanding defender in Virgil van Dijk. I read during the week that he hasn't been dribbled even once in the Premier League this season, which is insane.
Yeah, I don't know if that includes when he hacked Leroy Sané down for that penalty at Anfield against City, when he was sort of dribbled past, but he fouled him. So moving on from that, nevertheless, it's still impressive.
It is. And I mean, look, he generally plays on the left of the two centre-backs, doesn't he? So there is a chance there that he might be able to step out and quell Messi in that inside right pocket that the superstar likes to frolic in. But look, I'm not saying that that's going to be the solution to stopping Lionel Messi, because let's face it, James, that's impossible.
Yeah, kick him. Just kick him hard and kick him often. That's the only thing I can come up with, Alan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Feed him a dodgy lasagna, maybe.
Oh, good idea.
Like Spurs.
Yeah, the old Spurs trick. Yeah, well, I'll try. I'll see if I can get in touch with some restaurants in Barcelona. Alan, we'll have to leave it there. Time's catching up with us. But thank you so much for joining us. That's Alan O'Brien, tactictruck2.com, if you want to read more of Alan's excellent analysis.
Love sport.
You may also have heard me trying to predict, and you may have missed me trying to predict some results from last night's football. Ben likes to rerun them in an effort to make me look like an idiot. Here's what I had to say about Tottenham versus Ajax. Great game, absolutely great game. Tactically, particularly, I think, because Ajax, they have this style with three linking midfielders in the middle. One, De Jong, who sits much deeper than the others. Good ball carriers at the back as well. I think Tottenham will have to play quite defensively going into the game without so many of their top players. You'll probably rely on the likes of Moussa Sissoko to give them more energy, but I think they might try and sit back a little bit. I know they're at home. I know traditionally when you're at home, you have to try and dictate play, but I think Tottenham will be a slightly more defensive side than you'll be used to. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a stalemate. I think it'll be 0-0. Yeah, well, I mean, if Kieran Trippier's leg had been 6 inches further forward, it would have been 0-0 because Van der Beek would have been offside, eh? Give me some credit, come on. That's annoying. I thought I had it with 0-0, actually, and okay, yeah, fair enough, Tottenham got outplayed. But, you know, maybe they'll pull it back in the second leg, I don't know. Millwall were in action last night at the Den, is what I'd say about Millwall versus Bristol. Now, in our weekly predictions league, I smashed Millwall this weekend. They were hosting Stoke. They knew that a point would probably keep them safe. and they kept a point, and I was dead on with my stalemate prediction. I don't think it'll be like that tonight. Bristol City have all but waved goodbye to their promotion hopes, but they could and should have beaten Derby at the weekend, and I think they will come out probably with a bit of a bee in their bonnet, I would suggest. So I think they'll be going out and showing us something new. Millwall haven't got a lot to play for now that they're safe from relegation. I think it'll be a 2-1 win for Bristol City at the Den. Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. Yes. I've predicted 2 Millwall results in a row now, like on the money. It's getting weird, actually. I feel like I'm getting too much... So knowing too much about Millwall, I'm the Millwall Nostradamus. Did I manage it with Portsmouth versus Peterborough? Well, this is a nightmare, isn't it? Actually, it's a nightmare if you're a Luton fan at the moment, because the League One title race has closed right up with Barnsley now level on points with Luton. And if Portsmouth win tonight, they will be within just 1 point. I think, though, Portsmouth at home, it'll just be too much for them down on the south coast. They've produced a lot of very gutsy performances recently when Coventry went ahead against them, for example. They came from behind and were pretty impressive. So I think Portsmouth will pull off a 2-0 win. Well, they did score twice, so I was half right. All right, they lost 3-2, but I was halfway there, Ben. I think you should mellow that no sound. I think it needs softening. It's far too harsh at the moment. I don't deserve that sort of thing.
Love sports.
Rio Ferdinand, director of football, eh? Whatever next? The man who spent 20 years playing professional football, won 6 league titles with Manchester United and a Champions League to boot, who then, of course, once he retired in 2015, spent ages studying the game and... he really didn't, actually. He sort of set up a restaurant, he set up a clothing brand. Didn't exactly set himself up for a career working in the back office of a football club, but that is what we understand he is in talks to do. Met with Ed Woodward, who's interested in bringing him in as a director of football, a technical director, sporting director. We're not quite sure exactly what he's going to end up being, but it's certainly interesting to know whether he might be a suitable man for the job. Let's talk to someone who's been there, done that in just about every job in football. On the line now is former Nottingham Forest and Manchester City manager Frank Clark. It's always brilliant to speak to someone with such a wealth of experience in the game. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, and it's sort of related to this Rio Ferdinand story, is when you look at players who go through into the back room or end up as a director of football or a sporting director, whatever you want to call it, what do you think qualifies them to do that job?
Well, they need a lot more than just having been a very good player at that particular club. It depends what they want. I mean, you can call it anything you want, but it depends what they want them to do, what sort of structure they want to set up. If you want to be a sort of all-powerful director of football, you obviously need a very good knowledge of the game. You need a vast number of contacts throughout football in Europe and probably in the world. And a thick skin.
And presumably that, as you mentioned, it takes more than just having played the game for 20 years. That must take time to build that contacts book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people like the two fellas at Manchester City, they've been doing it for years. They must have the most amazing contact book imaginable. But it depends on the structure you want. You know, Liverpool do it slightly differently. They have almost like a small number of people you could call the committee, I suppose, who all get involved in the talent identification and the buying and selling of players. Some clubs have a one director of football who is all powerful, but it does take a long time to build up those contacts. That would worry me a little bit. Speaking about Rio or Mike Phelan, really. Both vastly experienced in the game, but I wouldn't have thought Rio would have that many contacts. As I say, it depends really what they want him to do. I mean, I think it's great that somebody like Rio comes back into the game in some capacity, but it depends on his job specifications.
You've obviously worked at all different levels in a football club. I wonder what you found to be the most effective system. Does it basically depend on communication between people? Because I read a story today saying that Solskjaer would prefer to have Mike Phelan as his technical director, but surely it doesn't make any sense to let the football manager appoint the technical director. It should be the other way around, shouldn't it?
Ideally, it should be, yes. It's an interesting word that you used there, James, communication.
Mm.
I mean, that is the key. To whatever structure you set up and whoever you bring in, you have to have trust, communications, and respect for each other, or it's not going to work.
Yeah.
It's important that the call on the director of football immediately establishes a good relationship with the chairman, with the manager.
Yeah.
But I certainly don't think that the manager should be picking the director of football. He could have a say in it, but ultimately it has to be the people who own or run the football club.
Mm.
And then it's up to the director of football and the manager to form a relationship based on trust and mutual respect.
Mm. I wanna...
But it won't work without that.
No, exactly. And that seems to be a common theme when we speak to people who work within football. It is about trust and respect as well. Frank, I feel it would be remiss of me to have you here and not ask you a little bit about Nottingham Forest, of course, because I know it's a club that you know extremely well. You played for them, you managed them. I wanted to ask you about that your time as manager there. And obviously, you followed Cluffy. There's no words for how difficult that job must have been. How did you approach that, trying to fill those shoes straight afterwards?
Well, I didn't try to fill the shoes. I knew it would be too big for me.
Yes.
So I tried to do it my own way.
Mm.
I did know. I knew it helped that I knew the club and a lot of the people there and the structure of the club. But I just, I just got in and dealt with the problems that were there. It was a help. And that Brian kept a very low profile after he left the club. He wasn't very well, so he kept a low profile. So it wasn't as though he was there in people's faces and in the newspapers all the time. That would have helped.
Yeah.
But I inherited a very good staff and some good people at the football club, and just got on and did the job in the way that I thought it needed doing.
Did you then? You must then have seen. I don't know if you saw this similarity, but certainly I saw it. Thinking about Sir Alex Ferguson at Manchester United and, the difficulties they've had replacing him. And of course, as you mentioned, Brian, for reasons beyond his control, didn't have much of a high profile when you were there. But Fergie has always been there, sitting in the stand with his name on it, watching the new manager try and fulfil him. That must put an awful lot of pressure on a manager.
I think it does. Listen, I'm not being critical of that. I mean, having a man like him around the football club and with his experience and stature and all that kind of thing can be a very positive thing. But it does put a little bit of pressure on the manager coming in. I mean, I don't know obviously what went wrong at Manchester United, what didn't work out.
Mm.
I just know that certainly in the first 3 years I was able to bring in some new players and made the team my team and not Brian's team.
Mm.
We still played passing football and tried to entertain.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really a problem. I mean, I knew the way he had run the club and I didn't run it the same way. Oh, that would have been impossible. Trying to emulate him would have been foolish.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But it went okay for a while anyway.
Yes, certainly did. Frank, time's catching up with us, but it's brilliant to have you on. Thank you so much for giving us your insight. Fascinating to speak to you as well. That's Frank Clark there, a Nottingham Forest legend. He played for them, he managed them, he was chairman there as well, and a man who knows football inside out, not to mention the fact that he had to follow in Brian Clough's footsteps at Forest. I don't envy that.
Love Sport.
Now, you will know the name Caster Semenya because she's been in the news, perhaps for all the wrong reasons, over the last couple of years. And the breaking news today is that she's lost her appeal against the IAAF's testosterone rules. It means if she wants to continue competing in the 800 metres, she's a double Olympic champion in that distance, remember, then she will have to take drugs essentially that limit her testosterone levels because they say her testosterone levels are too high. Now, Caster Semenya's medical condition is quite... not unique, but it's certainly quite rare. She's got differences of sexual development, they say, and it means that she has slightly elevated testosterone levels in her blood. Now, I'm not a scientist necessarily, I'm not a biologist, I'm not an anatomical expert, but I do know that the first rule of all sports science is that all athletes at the elite level are freaks, basically. they are freaks of nature. They're people with, you know, unusually long certain bits of muscle or unusually large bits of fast twitch muscle. Usain Bolt is an absurd individual when you look at what he's achieved. It's not a surprise because he, as a physical specimen, is unbelievable. He's rare. He's literally the fastest man ever to have run. And there's no way he could do that if genetically he wasn't very different. Now, of course, you can train, you can work hard, you can learn technique and things like that. But you can't replicate what he's been able to do thanks to an accident of birth. And Caster Semenya is the same. She happens to be a different woman from a lot of people, which means she can run fast over an 800 metre distance. But she's not cheating. She's not going out of her way to take testosterone. I tell you what, it sits really badly with me that Caster Semenya is not going to be allowed to run over the distance that she is best at in the world. And Jerelle Miller, who's admitted to taking a cocktail of performance-enhancing drugs, has been given a six-month ban by the WBA. If that doesn't sit badly with you, I don't think you fully understand how sport works. Caster Semenya is not a cheat. Jerelle Miller is. And yet she is going to be much more harshly regulated than Jerelle Miller. Let's talk to someone who can explain the intricacies of this case perhaps a little better to me. It's Mark Woods, athletics journalist, who is on the line just now. Mark, why don't you just tell us exactly what this ruling today means for Caster Semenya?
Well, the argument from the International Athletics Governing Body, the IAAF, was that athletes, particularly female athletes with an elevated testosterone count, shouldn't be able to run against athletes, female athletes with a normal testosterone count. And then you know, if you look at the proportion of what the measurement is, it's called nanomoles in your average woman, it's below 2. In men, it starts at 8, and those are the kind of targets and the differentials that we're talking about here. Now, what the IAAF wanted to do was essentially say, if you've got an elevated testosterone count, like Caster Semenya, like those athletes who are, we call intersex, that are athletes with different sexual development, that's the terminology, then we should be able to ask you to use drugs to regulate that, to bring your levels down, so therefore there's a level playing field for all the female athletes involved. And Caster Semenya took the IAAF to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. They have made their ruling today and they've said yes to the IAAF. Although we have some severe issues with your policy, we believe that if the essential aim of this, the essential target, can hold up.
Does she have any further... I mean, ICAS is usually known as the last court of appeal in these cases, as far as I can tell. Is there any way Caster can fight this? Because it's almost as though CAS have, maybe deliberately or not, left the door open by saying, you know, this does seem a little bit discriminatory, but we don't think it's completely wrong.
Well, she can appeal. There is an appeals process in this, and her lawyer has said that, you know, that there are issues to consider this. Semenya has herself said that she believes that the IAAF for a decade has tried to slow her down, and the decision of CAS will not hold her back. Now, you at the start of this hour said all the different dilemmas that are involved here. This is not a cut and dried issue. I mean, medically, yes, it's simple. What she could do now is effectively take your regular contraceptive pill, reduce her hormone and reduce the testosterone level and carry on competing. She has said that she doesn't want to undergo medical intervention. We don't know yet if that means that she won't take drugs or if she won't undergo some kind of surgical procedure or whatever. The truth is now it's a very grey area. In terms of CAS's rulings, it's not like a regular court. They don't set precedents. So the fact is they have said, in their words, this ruling is discriminatory, but we believe it's discriminatory for a particular reason in this case. So while this specific ruling right now can hold up, it's in no way the end of this particular issue, and it no way resolves things for the longer term, not just in athletics, but in other sports going forward.
What do you think the reaction, and what has been at least the early reaction of the athletics world on the whole? Are they generally pro Semenya? Are they generally pro the ruling?
As you'd expect, it's split down the middle. There have been a lot of prominent athletes, the likes of Paula Radcliffe, Sharon Davis, Liz McCulkin, they've all said, we have sympathy for Caster Semenya. This is not about discriminating against the individual. It's about allowing your average female to compete against your average female. As you said, what is an average sports people? You could look at basketball players who are super tall. You know, how should they be ruled out? You could look at Usain Bolt or you know, swimmers with big feet or who are super fast. You know, is that a physiological difference? You know, I think yes, it's a very specific and very difficult and very personal issue. You know, I mean, Semenya has shown incredible dignity over the past decade when people have analysed her in a very personal and intimate manner on this. But I think, you know, generally, you know, people want to see athletes competing fairly against other athletes. And as other runners who have lined up against Semenya have said in the past, you feel it's absolutely impossible for you to win because it's two different kinds of human being competing against another, and one has a set of chromosomes that has testosterone levels which are more typical of a male, and that is very, very difficult to counteract if you're competing one-on-one.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are some obvious points to make against it and say, well, look, if you line up on the start line next to Usain Bolt, you might think, well, actually, it's unfair. He's got more muscle fibres in these places. He's got more of these chemicals going through his body because of the way he's built. My own feeling, and you heard it earlier, is that I just don't think she's cheating. What do you think the upshot of all this would be? If you had to put your money somewhere, what do you think Caster Semenya will be running, let's say, at the Tokyo Olympics next year?
Well, she has said, "Yeah, this is who I am. I don't want to deny the person that I am and the natural abilities that I have." Mm. Now, the specific policy of the IAAF, which they have put into place immediately today, is that this applies only to 400 meters up to 1 mile. And it's based on research that they believe says that is the, in track events, certainly, that is the point where testosterone levels, if you have an elevated level, you get an unfair advantage in their eyes.
Right.
Now, Semenya can go above 1 mile. She could run at 3,000. She could run at the 5,000, which is an Olympic event at the South African Championships last weekend. She ran that distance and won it. So she has an option to just completely sidestep this ruling and move to a different level. Now, is that her best event? No, it's not. She's, you know, her times there are okay. They would be competitive, but not at the levels that they are at 800, where she's the Olympic and world champion. So I think, you know, she has an incredible dilemma. For me, I suspect that she might take that option now, but I think certainly this has been a very personally challenging court case, entirely personally challenging debate for South Africa. And whatever the arguments of the medical issue, I think everyone in athletics has incredible sympathy for the position that she's been put in.
Yeah, quite. And incredible sympathy for some of the people trying to investigate and calling into question some of, as you say, some of the more personal details about Caster Semenya's life, which don't seem relevant to me. Mark, thank you very much for your expert insight into that. Great to have someone's voice who really knows the ins and outs of the case. That's Mark Woods, athletics journalist, explaining to us exactly how Caster Semenya's case is going to work and where we go from here. Look, if she goes and runs the 5,000 metres at the Olympics next year, I, for one, will be cheering her on to win gold. Because if she goes on and wins a third Olympic title, two at 800 and one at 5,000, she will go down in history as one of the great athletes.
Love Sport.
And I want to talk more about that Jan Vertonghen injury. If you missed it, essentially he went up for a header and the keeper went in, Toby Alderweireld went in and Jan Vertonghen went in. And actually, initially, it looked like Onana, the Ajax keeper, had fouled him. What actually happened was that Jan Vertonghen headed the back of Toby Alderweireld's head. A nasty collision. He suffered a massive gash to his nose and he was treated for a number of minutes. He was then helped around the pitch. He looked pretty groggy, moving, taken up towards where the fourth official is, and medics checked him over and basically said, cleared into play. I saw him slapping the chest of one of his physios saying, go on, let me go, let me go. And the referee came over, made sure that everything had been followed, the concussion protocols, and he came back on the pitch. I don't think he lasted 30 seconds until he was saying, no, absolutely can't. He was rubbing his face, rubbing his eyes. He was very nearly sick. There's quite a harrowing image, actually. Mauricio Pochettino holding him up, you know, like he stood outside a kebab shop at 4 a.m. Ah, it's all right, Dave. Ah, yeah, get it out, mate. It's all right. There is no doubt in my mind that Jan Vertonghen should not have been allowed back onto that pitch, because it was a danger to his health. A lot of people don't necessarily know about second impact syndrome, or it's sometimes called repetitive head injury syndrome. And essentially, the first concussion is bad. Obviously, getting concussed is bad, and it can cause a swelling of the brain. But the second blow, if it occurs within minutes or even hours, actually, of the first concussion, can cause a lot more damage. You can get big bleeds, an inability to regulate the diameter of the veins in the brain, which means you get even worse bleeds than initially. It's very, very dangerous. I read an absolutely heartbreaking story about a young lad in Ireland who was playing rugby, took a knock to the head, and he was running around at inside centre, not really knowing what was going on, kept saying to his teammates, "I don't really know what's happening here." He got hit in the head again, and he very sadly lost his life. That's the kind of issues you're dealing with here. Concussion is not like a hamstring where you can try and run it off, or like a knock to the ankle, or you can try and somehow carry on. Concussion is something that can lead to short-term and long-term extremely serious effects. Dawn Astle was talking about it on Twitter last night. You may know Dawn. She's been on the stage. She's been on this show before. Her father was Jeff Astle, the former West Brom and England centre forward. Sadly passed away with dementia, and she is a co-founder of the Jeff Astle Foundation, which does research and awareness on brain injuries in sport. She was talking about how the PFA was super quick, and this is a quote from Dawn, super quick to spout part of the panel implementing head injury and concussion guidelines, not so quick to react to players' welfare. But worry ye not, families of your suffering former players and dead former players will do it for you again. Dawn, understandably, extremely angry that she is the one who has to bring this up, and it's not the PFA. And this is who should be doing it. The likes of the PFA should be standing up and saying, sure, Vertonghen wanted to go back on, but he shouldn't be having to make that decision. It should be irrelevant what Vertonghen wants to do at that point. You'll remember Hugo Lloris, 6 years ago, suffering a very serious concussion. I think it was against Chelsea off the top of my head, at White Hart Lane. Brad Friedel stripped off, ready to go. And Lloris went, no, I want to go back on. Fortunately, he eventually wasn't allowed to go back on. But there are a lot of conversations between the manager, between the physios, between the referee. Those people should have nothing to do with that decision. None of those people, barring perhaps the referee, and frankly he's not exactly trained, none of those people should be involved in the decision as to whether Jan Vertonghen, in this case, plays on. If you look at rugby, they have an independent doctor. Sometimes players don't even know that they have to go and have an HIA. The referee gets a noise in his ear and they say, oh, you've got to get number 9 off, we need to check his head, because we spotted him getting hit in the head in an earlier contact. And they just go, because they know that it's very serious if you get a concussion and all of a sudden you get a second one. And those head injury assessments, the HIAs, they're conducted off the field for 10 minutes with an independent doctor. Not someone who has to answer to the manager afterwards. Not someone who has to worry about their manager screaming at them in the dressing room saying, why didn't you let him come back on? He wanted to come back on. He could have won the game for us. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if Jan Vertonghen might have won the game for them. Who cares? It's a game of football. Realistically, what matters is his long-term health. And that's what you're risking with these head injuries. It can be as simple as one or two impacts that have life-changing and even, in serious cases, life-ending impacts. And football doesn't take it seriously enough. It really doesn't. That Jan Vertonghen, much as he might have passed the cursory protocols, and I'm not blaming the Tottenham medics for this, because I've no doubt they followed all the protocols and he passed them. But the protocols, frankly, are just not enough. You're telling me that in 2 or 3 minutes, you could work out whether Jan Vertonghen had suffered a concussion. The only way to deal with this is to introduce a temporary substitution. I think it happened, 10 minutes before halftime, is that right? Maybe 15? They could have taken him off for a head injury assessment, and actually they would have ended up having a bit more time because of half-time, and Tottenham wouldn't have been down to 10 men. The manager wouldn't have even batted an eyelid if they'd had a temporary substitution. Bring him on, sort it out. As it was, that substitution changed the game. It's kind of secondary, but it might have worked in Tottenham's favour as it happened. I'm glad to hear today the chairman of the FIFA's medical committee, Michel Dehuga, I'm sure I've murdered that, but that's who it is, said that concussion substitutions were a possibility and something worth discussing, although FIFA still has concerns. Look, I'm glad that at least FIFA are considering it. They consider a lot of things. But Dehuga says the advice from FIFA and UEFA is very clear. At every occasion before every tournament, we tell doctors they must follow the protocols. Protocols are not enough. You saw that last night. The protocols are inadequate. They don't involve a head injury assessment away from 80,000 people, in a room away from that, away from the noise, away from the pressure, by an independent doctor who does not have to answer to a manager. Football managers are particularly bad for ignoring player welfare, and the game itself is also particularly bad. And I'll leave you with the words of Johnny Gordon, who on Twitter is a Scotland FA first team doctor. And he said, and I can't put it better than this, "This is fundamentally an issue with player health. This is fundamentally an issue that requires rule change, and this is fundamentally an issue that requires the players to drive that rule change. Better medics than I have tried in football. We need player support to achieve this." I couldn't have put it better myself.
Love Sport.
Nerves starting to be overcome by excitement because Liverpool are now just 5 hours away from taking on Barcelona at the Camp Nou in a Champions League semi-final. Remember that we could have, it's unlikely, but we could in theory have four English teams in European finals this year, which would be quite a remarkable achievement, especially in the aftermath of a World Cup year in one of the most grueling leagues in the world. It'd be brilliant to get Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool and Tottenham. Yeah, neither of the Manchester teams. They're out, mate. Into the finals. I don't think it's going to happen. I think we might do well for two of them to make it through, to be honest, but we'll have to see. Tonight, Liverpool have to take on Barca. It's a very hard prospect to stop them. You know, they are... Lionel Messi's got 46 goals this season. I don't know how on earth you're supposed to deal with that threat. One thing Liverpool fans will always say is, we've got Virgil van Dijk. Now, the problem with it being a defender is you can't really just follow Messi around the pitch. It actually breaks up your system. Defending is all about systems, and while you can have good individuals within it, it's those systems that will really hold firm. So I don't know whether Liverpool will go down the route that most lower league Spanish sides go down, which is essentially get someone who's quite fit and get him to follow Messi for 90 minutes. It's not as though they're not short of threats elsewhere as well. You know, the likes of Coutinho and Suarez mean that it can be tricky. If you go around following Messi, all you do is create chaos and create space for other people. So they have to hope, I think, that Messi has a bad night. I mean, we all remember that fabulous performance 12 years ago now, when Liverpool came from 1-0 down, Craig Bellamy scored, John Arnautović scored, a famous 2-1 victory at the Camp Nou, of course. It took them to a Champions League final that they would eventually lose to AC Milan in 2007. But nevertheless, it was a decent Liverpool side, but it wasn't a brilliant one. And that's kind of the thing with Barcelona, is if you get them on an off night and you play as a team, I think you can just about manage it. Much as you obviously need Messi to have a bad night, I think it is doable. And this Liverpool side, they have the right sort of mentality and the right sort of clinical finishing in their team that they could, in theory, go and get something tonight. I don't know if they will, but it is possible. I think it'll be interesting to see if Liverpool press Barcelona. You know, we talked to Alan O'Brien earlier from Tactics Truck 2.0, and he said that Tottenham generally were out-pressed by Ajax last night. Barca, we know that, and one of the things that I always say about Barcelona is their work without the ball is underrated. And you can't underestimate how hard it is to play against Barcelona because they're in your face the whole time. Messi to a man, you know, all of them will press you and you have to not panic.